translation of Jurassic 7th year.
Depends how big your word is.
Yes, okay. So 6 seconds of a CD or a book. I mean, that's a book is quite a lot of information. So a megabyte is reasonable size. But now we're going up quite big powers. A terabyte, roughly speaking, 10 to the 12 bytes. Data collected in a single race from a Formula One car. I mean, that, you know, Formula One technology really is phenomenal, but this is one illustration of it. That lap time depends on a huge array of complicated factors, and teams are always trying to understand what it is that makes their car that little bit faster. 0.5% of the U.S. Library of Congress. Some of the really astronomical data set sizes really occur in astronomy. That maybe shouldn't surprise us. But 2% of the data collected by the Hubble Space Telescope. And even now we talk about exabytes. So this is another illustration of the way that astronomy is moving. One day's worth of data from the new Square Kilometre Array Telescope Initiative. So people in Cambridge, like Paul Alexander, are very heavily involved in these sorts of projects. Huge numbers of Cambridge academics are working with these huge data set sizes. So the data from the hippocampus, an area of the brain of 400 adult humans, or 4,000 students from Oxford. And the data of 40 days of Google search. Okay, so this is the sort of world we live in these days. Some sort of sense of the fields in which these data sets arise. Well, many of the statistical methods were developed to try to address challenges in genetics or genomic proteomics. So for instance, microarray data analysis was one of the primary movers of statistical methodology, because there it's often the case that you're interested in thousands of genes, tens of thousands of genes, but you only have of the order of tens of replications of your microarray experiment, and still you want to understand how these differential gene expression levels depend on these different genes. And also that gives you some sort of clue as to one way you might proceed, because in genetics, it's often reasonable to assume, at least as a first approximation, that the vast majority of genes have no effect whatsoever in the differential responses you're measuring. And so the challenge is to identify which ones are the important genes. So this idea of sparsity, which is one which underpins an awful lot of work in this area, is a very, very important idea. Text or document classification, I think many people, if you speak to people in CS, they've almost defined this to be the field of big data. This is really big in industry, in certain industry, certain parts of computer science. And neuroscience, fMRI, so if you divide your brain into 100 by 100 by 100 voxels, it's a 3D analog of a pixel. Then you take slices through these brains through someone's brain, not literally, that's through quantified scanning, and you collect very, very large quantities of data very quickly. EEG is another example of technology. I've actually been to the lab where you watch people doing EEG experiments, and they put these nets on, and then they you set these subjects different tasks that they have to. So they have a sensor in the right hand, a sensor in the left hand. So if they see something that's red or green, they have to click with their right thumb. And if it's blue or yellow, they have to click with their left thumb. So the problem is that the word might say blue, maybe written in green letters. So it's sort of deliberately designed to confuse you. This is the same experiment they do, though. It's quite interesting.
Did all of those, because they do all those in Chaucer Road.
That's where I went.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm part of that.
You're
old enough to be part of that.
Oh, right, okay.
That's what it is.
Yeah, it's
the student class.
group task, I think, wasn't it, where you voted brown as the letters green. And
yeah.
Group.
High energy physics, as you can imagine, the sort of CERN laboratory, they're smashing particles into each other at a phenomenal rate, collecting huge amounts of data, and then eventually reducing it to a single p-value. That's the outcome of billions of pounds spent on a project. Astrophysics, and as I've already talked about, of course, anything to do with the internet. Okay, so from a statistical point of view, what are some of the absolutely key developments? We're not really in a position to give any kind of meaningful historical discussion here, but I do want to say just a little bit about my favorite result in statistics, which is Charles Stein, 1956. So maybe I'll even write something on the board here. Piece of chalk. Okay, so I want to think about a situation where you've got an x which has got a p-variate normal distribution about a mean vector theta with an identity covariance matrix. So this is saying that each component of x is independent of each other, and xi has got mean theta I and variance 1. Okay, so just independent normal observations. And I see x and I want to estimate theta. This is about as simple a statistical problem as you could possibly imagine. But then I've got to tell you, well, what do you count as a good estimator? So I'm going to measure the loss that I incur if I use an estimator theta hat to estimate theta. I'll say that the loss I incur is the square of the error. Okay, that seems like a reasonable way to measure the quality of an estimate. And then, because this is a random quantity, so of course for any particular theta I might get my theta hat bang on, or I might get it quite a long way off. So to measure the overall performance, I'll write the risk function at theta to be the expected value of this square of the error. Okay? So what's the obvious estimator of theta here? I just think one realization of x.
Well, x itself.
X itself, right? That's the obvious thing to do. So if I call theta hat 0 of x, x, and I think, well, what's its risk function? Okay. So I've got to compute the expected value of the square of the length of x minus theta. But x minus theta is squared length, has got a chi-squared p distribution, so its expected value is just p. Okay. So for all theta, this risk function is exactly equal to p. And you sort of think, well, surely you can't do any better than that. But actually, Stein in 1956 showed that you can, and 5 years later in 1961, he came up with the James Stein estimator, or in collaboration with James, came up with the James Stein estimator, which is defined slightly more complicatedly like this. Okay, so I take x again, but now I'm pre-multiplying it by a scalar factor, and this scalar factor is less than 1. Okay? Notice that the ith component of this estimator depends not only on xi, but actually on all the components of x, even though I told you that the components of x are independent. So this is a little bit strange to get your head around, but what he was able to prove is that the risk function, maybe I should call this risk of theta hat 0, now I'll call this the risk of theta hat James Stein at theta, he was able to prove is less than p for all theta, provided p is greater than or equal to 3.
That's one observation.
One observation.
There is the possibility in that expression, the shrinkage factor there, that x bar squared may be less than P minus 2.
Yeah, that's right. So what he didn't prove is, okay, so this was my original estimator, theta hat 0, and this is its risk function, which is constant at P, and actually the risk function of his estimator looks like this. It's actually 2 at the origin, exactly. So whatever the true value of theta, the risk is smaller for the Jamestown estimator than the original vanilla estimator. And as Ted's just mentioned, well, this shrinkage factor could actually go negative, so you can actually improve this estimator by taking the maximum of it at 0. And in that case, the risk function looks something like that. Okay. Interestingly, you might ask, so is this estimator admissible? What do I mean by admissible? Well, we'd say inadmissible if I could find an estimator whose risk function were uniformly smaller than this guy. Okay.
There is another issue I've always had with this, as written there, that it shrinks x towards the origin.
Mm.
But in principle, the origin of x, the point from which you measure it, could be arbitrary.
It could. So you can easily shrink it to any predetermined theta 0, or indeed you can choose it in a data-dependent way, that you could shrink it towards x bar times 1p, for instance, provided you replace this p minus 2 by p minus 3, but I don't want to go into that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, yeah, so the question is this estimator admissible? And the answer is still no, actually, but you really can't beat this one by very much at all. Actually, if you just wanted an admissible estimator, it's not difficult to find one. If I set my theta hat to be 37, okay, regardless of the data, or 37, I need a vector, 37 times the null bit to be 37, so I say the first component is 37, all the other ones are 0, then the risk function will look like that. Okay. If the true value of theta is 37, then I do great. Well, 37, however I define, I need it to be a vector, but otherwise I do really, really badly. So really, what I'd really be after is some sort of admissible mini-max estimator, meaning it was never above p. You can find them, but they're quite difficult to find. Anyway, the point I really want to make is that this estimator was the first estimator to consider shrinkage and the power of shrinkage in terms of its ability to reduce bias in, generally, although this is introducing bias, but it's introducing bias, I mean introducing bias in order to reduce variance. Okay? And the trade-off that gives can sometimes be in your favor. In particular, it'll be in your favor in high-dimensional settings. So, this is a rather mathematical statistics problem, but translated to a linear model, which is a very common statistical model, Hurl and Kennard came up with the idea of rich regression. So this is, if you think about a linear model, instead of minimizing the least squares, actually you add some constant times the squared L2 norm of your vector of regression coefficients, then you end up with a rich regression estimator, which involves shrinking the original least squares estimator, and again you can get an improvement by a substantial reduction in variance for a modest increase in bias. Related ideas come in through some of the really pioneering work of Donohoe and Johnston to do with wavelet estimation, where you might want to kill some of the wavelet coefficients, the ones that are small, and this is again related to the idea of sparsity, which is this sort of key idea that I talked about a while ago. And now what I want to focus on a little bit more now is Rob Tibshirani's work in 1996 on the lasso, again very related to rich regression. Again, we're thinking about linear models, but instead of penalizing using the square of the L2 norm of beta, we're going to impose a penalty on the L1 norm of beta. So more specifically, let's suppose I consider this linear model here, a standard formulation of a linear model with n observations and p parameters to estimate, or a vector of p parameters to estimate, and I'm assuming then that the components of epsilon are independent. Then my lasso estimator I get is beta hat lambda, where I'm choosing beta hat 0 and beta hat lambda to minimize this expression here. So this would be the usual least squares penalty I want to minimize, but I'm adding an L1 penalty with some regularization parameter, as it's called, lambda, to be chosen. I'm adding this penalty here, which is having the effect of shrinking my least squares estimate towards the origin. In fact, what's particularly clever about this particular choice of penalty is that some of the parameter, some of the coefficients shrunk to being exactly zero. So a deficiency in a certain sense of the Ridge regression is that although the coefficients get shrunk, none get shrunk to being exactly zero. Whereas here, some of the coefficients get shrunk to be exactly zero. And this is related to the fact that if you think about the L1 ball, it has corners, and at the corners, some of the components are going to be zero. Whereas the L2 ball is nice and round, doesn't have any corners, and so you're not going to get any zeros in your vector and your parameter estimate.
Which feature of that expression makes some of the coefficients more vulnerable to shrinkage to zero than others?
Well, I'm trading off the fidelity of the fit against this this L1 penalty. So,
so it depends on the values in X.
Yes, it depends on X and on Y.
But you'd want to standardize your X's.
Yes, so that's a good point. If I use a least squares estimator ordinarily, I don't need to worry about standardizing my X's. But here, one feature of this estimator is that it's not scale equivariant. And so what people would do, typically, is that they would center and standardize each column of X so that it's got L2 length, the square root of N, say. That's the attempt to ensure that each variable is considered sort of equally important. Okay, so very broadly speaking, this was 1996, that Tipchirani came up with the lasso. Huge amount of work. Yes.
Why do you think it's standardized?
It's really more like XJ, the columns. So it's conventional to standardize them, because one effect here is that if I measure my covariate in centimeters rather than meters, then I don't want it to have a significant effect on the overall inference I'm going to draw. And a feature of this estimator that is not scale equivariant because of this penalty term, so I do the best I can, which is standardize them and try and sort of reduce the effect of that lack of scale equivariance as much as possible. Okay, so two very... I can define any procedure like that, but if I want to prove anything about the theoretical performance of this procedure, then typically I'm going to want to understand it. So two very broad general directions in which this field has gone would be, on the one hand, thinking about different sorts of penalty functions you might want to add to this least squares fidelity fit term to give you different sorts of properties. And one major split is perhaps too strong a word, division between the sorts of measures that have been proposed would be a question of whether this function's penalty function lambda would be chosen to be convex or not. If it's convex, then the overall minimization problem is convex, and that's nice, because that means that any local minimum of this objective function is a global minimum. So actually have no sort of problems around centered around local minima. But there are other more statistical reasons why you might want to have non-convex penalty functions. Some people believe in these things and other people not so much. The idea would be that a drawback of the lasso estimator is that it's giving you bias even in the large coefficients. And ideally you'd like to try to avoid that. And so you'd like to penalize the small coefficients but not the large ones so much, and that sort of leads you towards a non-convex penalty function. But then, as I say, in general the overall objective function isn't going to be convex, and you have to deal with this issue of the fact that you might have multiple local optima. I think I'm perhaps better not, I could say rather more about that, but I think I perhaps won't here. Many different penalty functions have been proposed. Lots of them have fancy names like SCAD or the Elastic Net or MCP or SILO or SIS. Now, SIS is a slightly different type, what else can I think of? Bridge regression, the adaptive lasso. I'm sure I'm thinking of forgetting several. So certainly lots of different penalty functions. The other sorts of extensions people have thought about is, well, of course it's not the case that every statistical model you might want to consider is a linear model. So you might be dealing with logistic regression, or binomial regression, Poisson regression, GLMs, or more generally some sort of pseudo-likelihood sort of model for data having different sort of structures. And then, you can imagine that you've got a whole matrix of possibilities where you've got sort of models going down this, going down the rows, and you've got penalty functions going across the top. And it's maybe not quite true to say that there's been a paper written that fills every sort of box in the matrix, but it certainly wouldn't be a sparse one. Yes, and then also different sorts of structure in terms of sometimes you have variables which are grouped in a natural way. So there's a nice paper on the group. Okay, so now I want to talk about some of the work that I've done in this area, and it very much builds on a paper by Nikolai Meinshausen and Peter Buhlmann in 2010. It was a JRSSB discussion paper, and it's called stability selection. Incredibly simple idea, but very, very general technique to try to improve the performance of an existing variable selection algorithm. So the idea is this, that instead of applying your favorite variable selection procedure to just once to the whole data set, what you might do is take subsamples of the observations, okay, so I'm subsampling rows of my data matrix, and apply my procedure on each subsample and see which variables get selected on the subsample. And then I'm going to say, well, the really important variables are surely the ones which keep coming up again and again and again on the subsamples. And the idea is that this might be a more effective variable selection method than the original base procedure. You can imagine you can apply this to any of these sort of linear models, generalized linear models, pseudo-likelihood models, any of those sort of models, data generating mechanisms, and for any of your favorite choice of base selection procedure, whether it's the lasso or the adaptive lasso or the scan or whatever it might be. So it's really a very, very general sort of technique. And one of the very nice features of this method is it gives you a finite sample upper bound on the expected number of falsely selected variables. So this is one of the two sorts of errors that you might make when you're doing variable selection. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that, but I need a little bit of notation to do it. I'm just going to imagine a setting where I've got IID random vectors Z1 up to Zn. So I'm going to think of some of the components of of each Zi as being signal variables and some of them being noise variables. I actually don't want to be too precise about what I mean by a signal variable and noise variable. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not. Because for us that's not going to be so important, but I'll come back to that in a moment. Anyway, the sort of thing I might have in mind is where you have covariate response pairs of the form XIYI. So you've got some high-dimensional covariate living in some p-dimensional space and a scalar response yi. And then you've got some log likelihood, which might look like this. So it's a sum of each of the individual contributions from each of the individual terms. And what I'm assuming in this model is that the effect of each coefficient is seen through some linear predictor, xi. So if this were my context, and this is by no means restricting myself to this context, but if this were my context, then I'd be thinking of the set S as being a set that my signal variables would be the ones with non-zero coefficient, and the noise ones would be the variables with zero coefficient. Okay. In other words, my signal variables are some subset of 1 up to p, and the noise ones are the complement of that set. And just so I fix my notation, a variable selection procedure is going to be a statistic that's a function of my data, and it takes values in the set of all subsets of 1 up to p. So s hat n is going to report the variables that I think are the important variables. Okay. One more piece of notation I'm going to need.
One particular point to clarify what you just said. Go back one. You described a variable selection procedure as a statistic calculated from z, which is the pair xi and yi. So
not necessarily. As an example, I gave this situation.
Okay. So z more generally means?
They're just IID random vectors.
Uh-huh. Usually one interprets the term statistic as meaning a function whose value is calculated from given the values of the data.
This is my data set 1 up to zn.
Okay, IID random vectors, right.
Can the xi be correlated?
Yes. Within each xi. But x1 up to xn would be independent. So, because I'm going to be thinking about subsampling the observations, I'm going to want some compact notation. So I'll say, if I've got a particular subset of 1 up to n, then I'll write s hat of a for the variables I select when I apply my base procedure on that particular subset of the data. Does that make sense? So Nikolai and Peter's procedure said, okay, for each variable k, I'm going to compute the proportion of times across all possible subsets of size n over 2 that variable k got chosen by my selection procedure. And then for some threshold, tor, which I'm going to have to choose, and I'll say more about that later, the set of variables chosen by stability selection are those where the proportion of times that variable gets chosen on subsamples is at least tor.
So that's all possible ways of taking and dividing into two equal size groups.
Yes, so you can already
see. Do it on half.
Yes, and I want to talk about that and about whether it's realistic to go through all n over 2 subsamples.
Yeah.
But I'll save that for one more slide of time. Here's the main theorem that justifies the use of stability selection in Nikolai and Peter's paper. It relies on two assumptions, one of which I regard as extremely strong, and the other of which I regard as weak and harmless. Here's the extremely strong one. It says that the set of random variables, the indicator function of whether or not variable k gets chosen by my base selection procedure when k is a noise variable, is exchangeable. So the definition of exchangeable may not be familiar to you all. It means that the joint distribution of this set of random variables indexed by the k in the set of noise variables doesn't depend if I permute if I permute the variables around. And in particular, what that would mean is that each individual variable has the same distribution. In particular, each individual variable would have the same mean. So each variable has to have the same probability, each noise variable has to have the same probability of being chosen by my base procedure. Now, Why do I think that's very strong? Well, because typically what you'd imagine is that some of my noise variables are very highly correlated with signal variables, and some of my noise variables really aren't highly correlated with signal variables. And you could, should imagine that if you've got a noise variable that's highly correlated with signal variable, it's got a higher, bigger chance of being picked up by mistake by my variable selection procedure. And so I don't think it's particularly realistic to think that every noise variable's got the same selection.
So that sort of thing here is real noise, real, nothing to do with it.
It doesn't mean it's not marginally correlated with the response.
Exactly. The same degree.
But it just means that conditional on the other variable, on the other signal variable. And the harmless assumption is that the original base procedure isn't worse than a random guess. Okay, so I think we can all agree that that's fairly harmless. If I don't do worse than just ignoring the data totally and just choosing which of my my signal variables are random. So then this theorem says that, well, provided my threshold's bigger than a half, I'll think about the expected number of noise variables that get chosen by stability selection. The expected number of noise variables as a false selection rate, right, is bounded above by a quantity involving three terms. Now, the p here I know, that's nice, and surprisingly that's on the bottom, right? Because normally we're used to recursive dimensionality, that as the dimensionality increases, the problem gets harder and harder, but here you're seeing that the bound improves as the dimensionality increases. Actually, that's not so surprising when you think about it. If you've got a really, really huge model, it's very unlikely that any particular noise variable is going to get chosen frequently enough for it to be selected overall. What this bound is not...
One might also say the same sort of thing about a signal variable.
Yes. What this bound is not telling you about is the fact that there are two types of error you might make when you're doing variable selection. You might select a noise variable, or you might fail to select a signal variable, and that latter mistake will certainly be more prevalent when your dimensionality increases. So that this is only telling you part of the story. Anyway, this is this guy here. This is the expected number of variables you get chosen by your base procedure. That's something that's within your control. I might fix my base procedure to choose 50 variables on each subset, for instance. And then you've got this quantity involving the threshold tau. So the idea described in the paper would be, well, as a practitioner, you say to your practitioner, what level of false selection rate would you be prepared to tolerate? And they give you, they say, well, on average, let's say one variable I'm happy if it's wrong. Well, I know P, I know this guy, so then I just have to choose my threshold tor to satisfy that, to guarantee that level of false selection rate. Does that make sense? So it's very nice because if you can imagine, I mean, the simplest model you could think of would be something like the lasso, and I say to a practitioner, what value of lambda do you want in your lasso? I haven't got a clue, right? It's completely meaningless to a practitioner a priori. Whereas this is something, a false selection rate, this is something that means something to a practitioner that they can realistically think of, think about and try to choose this tuning parameter tor. So I want to talk about, I really like this theorem, but I want to talk about three of the problems with it. One, I've already said it involves two conditions, and one of them is extremely strong. Another, as I already alluded to in answer to one of David's questions, you've got way too many subsets to evaluate, where even when you've only got 20 observations, 20 choose 10 is absolutely enormous, right? Way too big to evaluate. That's not really too serious a problem, because what you're going to do in practice is just take subsamples of size n over 2. You would take capital B subsamples and think of that as a proxy for pi hat of k. Now, it's not too much of a problem in practice, but the theory doesn't apply to that particular version of this. I would say that's the least significant of these three problems, but nevertheless it is a bit of a problem. The third aspect is that the bound tends to be rather weak. So you want to have one false selection on average, and actually what you're guaranteeing is no more than 0.1 selection, say. And this has trouble on the other side because it means you don't end up selecting very many variables. And that is what you notice when you try and apply this sort of method in practice, that it's rather skewed towards one sort of error. You just end up not quite choosing enough variables. And these are the problems that I want to try to, that we were trying to address. In terms of the original methodology, the change I want to make is a very, very small one. And here it is. Just saying, instead of randomly subsampling subsets of size n over 2, I'm going to, whenever I apply my basement procedure on one subset of size n over 2, I'm also going to apply it on its complement. Okay? And the reason why this helps is because what goes on the two different halves is independent. And you can exploit independence in proving that. So we're just going to choose these complementary pairs, each of size n over 2 again. And then, just as before, I'm going to count the proportion of times that variable k gets selected on each of the subsets, and eventually select the ones that come up. So here are the corresponding bounds. Actually, I want to try to do this without having any kind of conditions on the underlying data generating mechanism. And so, for me, the fundamental quantities we're interested in are not whether or not these are signal or noise variables, but because we're contingent on the choice of a base procedure when we're doing similarity selection or complementary pair similarity selection. And so, if your base procedure is, I'll take a random guess, you certainly can't hope that by doing the subsampling and aggregating, then you're going to improve that. So that's kind of clear. So all you can really hope is that the variables that have high selection probability under the base procedure definitely are going to get chosen by your complementary pair similarity selection, and the ones that have low selection probability under the base procedure should get ignored. And so what you can think of is then that what you're really trying to estimate is these selection probabilities, these pkn's, the probability that variable k gets chosen by this selection procedure. Now, and then you can think, well, when you do your vanilla lasso to the whole data set, you're really estimating this pkn by an indicator function, just the indicator function of whether k is an s hat n. Now, that's an unbiased estimator, because the expectation of the indicator function is by definition just this probability. But it's a high variance estimator. And so what you can think of it is that this this stability selection is a bit analogous to bagging. You introduce some bias, because when I apply the procedure to subset of size n over 2, the expectation is no longer pkn, it's pkn over 2. Hopefully that shouldn't be too far away, but it is going to be in general a biased estimator. But I get to aggregate, I get to average over many, many replications of this subsampling procedure, and so I'm going to get a very substantial reduction in the variance. That's my hope.
Can you explain bagging?
Bagging is short for bootstrap aggregate. And it's the way of, it's a way of improving the performance of a prediction algorithm just by, instead of applying your prediction algorithm to the whole data set, you take a bootstrap subsample of your original data and use it to predict, and then you repeat the different bootstrap subsamples, and then you aggregate the average. So again, you've got introducing some form of bias by doing the subsampling or the bootstrap sampling, because you're not getting to sample from the underlying population as you'd like to, you're sampling instead from the empirical distribution of the data. but you're getting this variance reduction that's coming from the averaging process,
Richard, sorry, I've forgotten. Your basic technique, are you assuming the lasso, or is that regeneral?
This S hat N is any
yeah,
variable selection procedure. Right. Yeah.
But it would be something like?
Could be the lasso, so what I'm going to talk about, instead of having noise variables and signal variables, I'm going to talk about low selection probability variables and high selection probability variables. And I want to avoid getting low selection probability variables, and I certainly want to get high selection probability variables. So the R analog of the Meinhausen and Bullman bound is this one. It's got no conditions whatsoever on it, and it just says that if tor is greater than half, then the false selection rate, what I mean by false is the number of low selection probability variables that get chosen, is bounded above by a quantity that's rather similar to what we had before. Certainly you've got the 1 over 2 tor minus 1 factor. You want to think of this theta as being something like the average selection probability across all variables. So if I choose q variables on each subset, then theta would be q over p. That's what I'm sort of typically thinking of here. And then this is very much like the bound that we saw before. Notice that in my definition here, I've explicitly accounted for the fact that I'm not going to be able to subsample all my n choose n over 2 different subsets here. So that's got rid of that second problem that I talked about.
So would you elicit theta by asking people what proportion of the variables do you think are important?
No, on each subset I have to choose a particular number that I'm going to select each time. I know what p is. Now you could do that in different ways, really. I think how many variables get chosen on each different subset. Maybe I can talk a little bit more about that. There's also the other sort of error you might make. How many high selection probability variables might you ignore? And this is a corresponding bound going the other way. Unfortunately, and I'll have to come back to this, the range of tor for which you've got actually control of both these sorts of errors is disjoint, which is a little unfortunate. But I'm going to focus on this bound because this is the one that we can hope to improve most. Okay, so the sort of situation I have in mind as a numerical illustration, let's say I've got 1,000 variables. By today's standards, that's actually not a particularly large number variables. And let's suppose that I'm choosing 50 variables on each of the subsets. So then my theta, the average selection probability, would be 50 divided by 1,000, 0.45. And then if I use my complementary pairs probability selection with tor as 0.6, then this factor here is, so I've got 0.05 divided by 1.2 minus 1, 0.2. So for 0.05 times 5 is 0.25. So what I'm saying is that on average, this complementary pair stability selection is selecting no more than a quarter of the low selection probability variables chosen by the original base procedure. Okay. And that's by no means extreme. I haven't cooked that up to be especially advantageous to this. So as I said, there's no extendability or random guessing conditions. This theorem holds even when you only choose one complementary pair. That's already giving you some sort of indication that hopefully you might be able to improve this theorem somehow. But if the random guessing and exchangeability conditions do hold, then you could get a bound that's just a little bit better actually than the original Meinhausen and Bullman bound. Okay, now I'm going to do something very dangerous. I'm going to prove the proof is quite short, it only two slides, and it's only really the first one that I want to concentrate on. I'm going to define another quantity, pi tilde b of k. Pi tilde b of k is the proportion of times variable k gets chosen on both complementary pairs. Okay? I'll call that the simultaneous selection. And notice that if I want to compute the expected value of this guy, it's an empirical average. So the expectation is just the average expectation of any one of those summands, okay, because these are identically distributed. But then crucially, what's going on the different halves of my complementary pair are independent, and each of the individual terms has got expectation pkn over 2, so the overall guy's got expectation pkn over 2 squared. I'm really interested in this when k is a low selection probability variable. So when k is a low selection probability variable, pkn over 2 is small, and so its square should be really, really small. So this random variable pi tilde b of k is it's a proportion, so it's taking values 0 or 1 over b or 2 over b, 3 over b, up to 1. But it's got a very, very small mean, so it's going to have a lot of mass on 0. Now I do the following calculation. I say 0 is less than or equal to 1 minus an indicator function times 1 minus an indicator function. Same when I add them up and divide by b. And if I just multiply out that expression, I get 1 minus twice the thing I'm wanting to study plus this simultaneous selection probability. Okay. So, now I can say that the probability that the proportion of times that the variable gets selected on the subsamples is greater than or equal to tor, I can rewrite using this inequality like this and equivalently like this. So I've rewritten this or bounded this in terms of the simultaneous selection probability. Now all I do from here is apply Markov's inequality. So I just say the probability that this guy is greater than some threshold is less than or equal to its expected value, that's coming from here, divided by the threshold. And once I've got that, I'm almost there. This is really the key step and the one I'm going to come back to. It's almost there. This might look complicated, but really I'm not really doing anything. This expected value, that's the left-hand side of the statement in the theorem, that's just, I can write it as a sum of indicator functions, I can take the expectation inside, I can use a bound that came from the previous slide, and then I can take out one of these pk n over 2s because I'm only interested in the set bounds. But this guy just has this expression like this. Okay. So that's all pretty straightforward on that side of putting things together. But it's really this bound here where all the action's happening. Before I talk about improving the bounds, I want to just give you one quick slide that's almost humorous, I think. You've got this bound. The only assumptions that I've got in this theorem are my data are independent and identically distributed. And now I'm going to get rid of those assumptions. So I'm going to do guaranteed variable selection with no assumptions whatsoever, just that I've got some data. Okay. First of all, I'll get rid of them in two stages. First of all, if they're not identically distributed, then I need to redefine what I mean by a low selection probability variable. And I mean then the average of the selection probabilities across all subsets of size n over 2. Okay. That's but that's because these guys aren't identical in that case. If I get rid of the independence, then I need to define this square of this guy as the average of this simultaneous selection probability over all the complementary pairs. But if I make those redefinitions, exactly the same bound holds as I had before. Now, statisticians tend to be a pretty skeptical bunch. Mm-hmm. And if I say I can really solve your problems with absolutely no assumptions whatsoever, people like David will say, whatever. And so, of course, where's the catch? Well, I think in some situations you're going to find that this bound is quite weak, and that's the trouble. And so, rather than trying to go in this direction of removing assumptions, what I'm instead going to do is try to impose what I think are reasonable modeling assumptions in order to try to improve the strength of the bound, and hopefully get a better trade-off between this false negatives and false positives. Types of errors that I might make. So here's just a sort of simulated example to show you what I'm talking about and how we might hope to improve on Markov's inequality. Where do you get equality in Markov's inequality? So if I want to maximize the probability of being greater than 2 tor minus 1, and I've got a fixed value for how big the mean can be. This is remember a random variable that takes value 0, 1 over b, 2 over b, whatever. This means very, very small. Then what I'm going to have to do is put a very big mass on 0, but then put as much mass as I can on 2 tall minus 1 to satisfy the mean constraint. Does that make sense? Okay. So the picture looks something like this. I want to have a big mass on here, as much mass as I can out here on 2 tall minus 1. There's no point putting anything bigger than 2 tall minus 1, because then that's increasing the mean unnecessarily without any gain. But the black thing lines are what I actually see in a simulated example. It's not cooked up to be especially special. It does have a large mass on 0. We have to expect that. But then you see this much more regular decay of the probability masses as you move away. It would be a very strange distribution of that simultaneous selection probability that had a large mass on 0, no probability of it happening once, no probability of happening twice, but then suddenly by the time you get to five, you know, the probability of it happening 5 times actually is positive. That would be a very strange distribution. In fact, if you look at the blown up plot just from 0.2 onwards, you see that the extremal distribution in Markov's inequality is giving massive weight up here, but the simulation is giving some tiny masses here. So that's really where you're throwing away a huge amount of Markov's inequality. Yes?
But in these simulations, what is
M? I can't remember, to be perfectly honest. It wasn't a particularly carefully chosen simulation in some.
Can you please repeat why
is
that the first
because I want to try to maximize the probability of being greater than or equal to 2 tall minus 1. Okay. And I've got a constraint on how big the mean can be. It's got to be equal to this. So that means I should put as much mass on 2 tall minus 1 as I can, but I can't be put too much because I've got to satisfy the mean constraint, and the rest had better go on 0. Make it as small as I can. So now I can need more complicated expression, but the first way you might try and improve this would be to say, well, it's kind of ridiculous to have this bimodality here, a big mass 0, 0, 0, and then a positive mass. So what if we said that this distribution was unimodal? That seems very reasonable. Then you can get a new version of Markov's inequality that works for unimodal random variables supported on a lattice, and you can get a bound here with a constant that's just a little bit more complicated than the 1 over 2 tall minus 1 that I had before. It's basically better by a factor of 2. This you should think of being very small when b is large, for a certain range of tor, and then this is actually a better improvement when tor is really quite large. And if you look at the picture now, well, still unfortunately, even though we now have, so the extremal distribution now puts a large mass on 0, then is constant at a certain non-zero level that goes beyond 2 tor minus 1, and then it drops down to 0. Yeah. Now we're doing a bit better at matching what you're seeing in a particular data example, but it's still quite a long way off. So it seems that you could actually impose rather stronger assumptions. And I was really tempted to say, well, what if we suppose that this guy has a log concave distribution? I've done a lot of work on log concavity. I love that as a constraint. So it was very tempting. And in fact, if these Samans were independent, this would have a scaled binomial distribution. That would be log concave. But the Samans aren't independent. And when we tried it, it turned out that that constraint was just a little bit too strong to match real data examples. So what we did was we found some way of interpolating between unimodality and log concavity using a constraint called R concavity. It doesn't really matter what the constraint is, just that it gives you another way of establishing a bound, a new version of Markov's inequality, that now the bound is less explicit, but you can evaluate it without any difficulty numerically. We did a lot of simulations with a lot of different data generating mechanisms, a lot of different Bayes selection procedures, and really quite a conservative choice we found is to choose R as minus a half. And now you see that this extremal distribution is definitely more closely matching what you're seeing in practice. One more improvement you can make is that instead of working with this simultaneous selection probability, you can just work with this guy, this original guy that we had to start with, and you can apply Markov's inequality directly to that, and then you get the better of two bounds if both your assumptions hold. And then this is the overall picture you get. So this is the way that the true number, simulated lots of times, the true error varies as you vary tor. So when tor is 0.5, through lots of simulations, we found that on average, you are selecting about 2 or 2.5 low selection probability variables. But this is the Meinhausen-Bullmann bound, this top line here. And remember, that blows off to infinity when tor is a half. So it's only going to be any good beyond that. And even then, there's a huge gap in these bounds. You're getting a very poor reflection of the true trade-off between false negatives and false positives. This one just below it was our bound based on no assumptions whatsoever. This is our unimodal bound, and this is our best bound here, based on the minimum of two quantities, and this kink is just where the minimum is changing from being attained by one of the things to being attained by the other. Yeah.
Do you mean that if the variables were simulated,
were correlated? No, I don't. I'm sorry. Branch into the simulation. So this latter bound, the last bound, enabled us to get the bound going backwards to the left of 0.5. So there is a range of tor where you've got this simultaneous control for both the false selection rate and the false non-selection. So I've probably gone on way too long, but I just want to summarise and say, certainly I consider variable selection to be one of the most important problems in modern high-dimensional statistics. It's at the heart of what statisticians can contribute to the study of big data. Complementary pair stability selection is a very general way of improving the performance of any variable selection algorithm with any data generating mechanism, and it's designed to improve its performance. And you can give pretty reasonable finite sample bounds on the average number of low selection probability variables that get selected, depending on what assumptions you're prepared to make, they can either be okay bounds or really quite good bounds if you're prepared to make reasonable modeling assumptions. And this bound allows the practitioner to choose this threshold, which is the tuning parameter in this method, in a meaningful way, but also in an effective way that gives the practitioner some security, but also a reasonable trade-off between false negatives and false positives. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
So this is the main paper here on which this work was based in the second half of the talk.
Further comments?
So if we apply this method to, say, one of those earlier emissions, the going back to square one, because some of them are still there, which we don't know. So there's still some, I don't know, gray area, what do you call it, practically?
Certainly, what can I say? There are many situations where you can't be certain you've got the right set of variables. One thing that certainly just makes you have a difficult problem is if you've got very correlated variables in your design matrix, particularly when noise variables and signal variables are highly correlated. Any variable selection method is going to struggle in that situation. It's just a hard problem. And so complementary pair stability selection with any base procedure is no different. What you would find there is that a lot of the variables, if that were the case, a lot of the variables would have very similar selection probabilities. So sort of try to separate them out into low selection probability variable and high selection probability variable is a much more challenging task than if you have, say, uncorrelated variables. At least, though, you see the design matrix, you can compute the correlations, so at least you know when you're potentially in trouble.
So this method won't have any application to uncorrelated data?
I think it could do. I think my point is any method will struggle. I don't think this will particularly struggle worse than other methods. But it's just a hard problem. I don't want to... I think maybe you misinterpreted what I say. I wasn't saying this method is not designed for that. Well, no method can really cope all that well with very, very highly correlated variables. But I don't want to say that it will fail as soon as you've got any correlation.
Those variables highly correlated one to orthogonally identify
that may well be a very sensible thing to do, and you can, yes, what you might lose is a certain amount of interpretability.
Yeah, with principal components you get a certain small dimension out, but then you can express those variables linearly in terms of all the others because of the interdependence. Anyway, the general point I was going to raise, there's a kind of continuum in this kind of problem from reasonably well defined to completely indeterminate. Say you've got 1,000 variables, 50 replicates, under some conditions your chance of being able to detect anything reliable may be very close to zero.
Mm-hmm.
For other conditions, your chance may be very good. And I was wondering what, as it were, features determine the move, the progression from one end to the other.
Two really important features. One would be something like what we call a compatibility constant or a restricted eigenvalue. Maybe that's a little more technical than I want to give the formal definition right here, but it's a characteristic of the design matrix that you want some directions in which you have some sort of strong convexity. But the other condition you want is, of course, you don't want to have an awful lot of very weak features. So if a lot of theorems would involve what we call a beta min condition, saying that the minimum signal strength is at least as big as something. So it's those two features that really seem to characterize how hard the problem is statistically.
Yeah, basically that seems to boil down to the distribution of the x's being fairly close to an approximation to a low dimensional space.
No, I don't think so. I mean, if I had random design covariates drawn from a standard normal distribution, that would be about as great as a situation as I could hope.
I
mean, it's very easy to describe to someone what to do. Just do your favourite thing, but keep on chopping your data in half.
Yes.
Do it in both bits.
Yeah.
And use the variables that come up a lot.
That's
it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'll say, is that all? I've been spending years working on that.
Did I try to make methodology sound complicated?
Of course, the trick is then saying, well, what does often enough mean?
Often enough, yes. And what control are you
and
getting?
And what are you getting from it?
In terms of this, you know.
But if you just tell them it's a good way of doing things, do they? Oh, I see. Because they want them to work out what tour is.
So
have
they have to choose the tour.
Yeah.
And
things come up.
You want to. So you can ask them the question, well, how many false selections would you be prepared to tolerate on average? And I think that seems like a reasonable way to try to elicit from them a value from which you can choose to tour.
Yeah, so I'd say one way, one, make sure they don't do anything sort of like tour the really stringent criteria. So you've got to come up all the time.
Right, because then you're not going to choose them very many variables.
No.
That's and of course, for different applications, the trade-off might be quite different. It may be very, very expensive to investigate every single gene that you end up selecting in greater detail. Whereas in other applications, you might really just not want to miss anything important. You don't really care too much if you've got way too many still. You just want to get down from a fast number down to a more manageable number. It's more like a screening kind of process.
So if someone said, well, how many splits do I have to do?
Yeah, 50 splits in the complementary pairs.
So you just have to run it 100 times?
Yeah, so if you think about the computational burden, most variable selection algorithms, things like the lasso, if p is bigger than n, they're order n squared algorithms. So you're gaining because you're only having to do it on subsets of size n over 2, so you gain by a factor of 4 when you square it. But if you're doing it 100 times, overall it's still 25 times worse. Now, of course, what that ignores is the fact that it's totally trivial to parallelize this. So if you've got a cluster, you can do it 4 times faster, in principle, than running the original lasso. So I don't think that computationally it's a significant issue.
Yeah, following that, why? Is there any reason why you think it's best to do this partition in such a way that you just take n over 2 and then the complementary or not different ways of partitioning this?
Yes, so you can think of subsampling as being a particular instance of what are called exchangeably weighted bootstrap schemes. So you probably know the ordinary non-parametric bootstrap when you resample them with replacement, with each one having what probably 1 over n being chosen. And so amongst all the subsampling fractions you might take, like n over 3 or n over 4, n over 2 turns out to be, in a certain sense, the closest amongst all these things to exchangeably weighted bootstrap schemes. Choosing a subsample fraction of a half gives you the closest mimic of the standard non-parametric bootstrap. Now that's not a kind of optimality criterion itself, but we know and love the ordinary bootstrap, and we're very comfortable with how it's used, so it sort of suggests it's a reasonable thing to do. Actually, someone else has written a paper extending what we've done to general K, where you might be getting the K over K thing, but that's not
really. So there is no result saying that the balance couldn't be improved.
No, I think, I mean, you get bounds of a slightly different nature, but you can go through the exercise. It's, you know, a good exercise for a student. Actually, it's only about 2 lines of code. That it's not really, you've got the lasso code is already in whatever package you want. You just have to write a loop on the outside to do the subsampling and run it on each of the subsamples. There's almost nothing to do. You can do it in 5 minutes.
And wouldn't it be natural to do that and then to plot, you know, to vary in tool how many you might accept? You run sort of specifying first.
You run the whole, you sort of plot the whole path of things.
Yeah.
Yes, you can do that. So
look at where it drops down some using.
Yes, that could be nice thing to do. One reason why we haven't sort of done an R package ourselves is because essentially we'd be really stealing other people's work, because the main work was to come up with the base procedures in the first place. And our algorithm could use any one of those things. So you'd have to have an argument that called glmnet or scan routines or whatever it was. And really it would be a little bit unethical of us to sort of write our own package that's got two lines around calling, calling someone else's function to look like that. It's not difficult. That was really, I guess, what all these bounds were about. You asked your practitioner what level of low selection probability variables that they would be prepared to tolerate being chosen, and then because you know this constant, then you can work out a suitable value for that. I mean, it's more explicit in these early examples. Like this one, for instance. So I know this guy, I know this guy, I choose the tool to control this guy at whatever level the practitioner wants to specify.
Do you know if the estimator tool depends on n?
In general, it would. I mean, you might well choose this to depend on n, but then also the number of variables that the number of mistakes a practitioner would be prepared to tolerate would probably change with n.
You are, so to speak, pushing the responsibility of the tool onto the practitioner.
Partly.
Because suppose you ask the practitioner what level tool you're prepared to accept, and he says the best you can get.
Oh no, then I think you have to say
then you're in a vicious circle.
No, I just say to the practitioner, well, the trouble is that the larger I make Tor, the fewer mistakes of this type I'll make, but the more mistakes of this type I'll make. And so they have to be aware that there's a trade-off between the two sorts of error. I think that's very obvious, isn't it? If I set the threshold very high for how often a variable has to come up for me to call it significant, then I'm not going to end up choosing very
often. So you could in fact present them with a kind of spectrum for different values of Tor.
That's what David was saying,
I'd want to see a little plotted against Tor.
I think that's perfectly feasible to do, yeah. Then you don't need any of this theory.
Well, if no one else is coming in, thank you once again very much, Richard. Delightful combination.